I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What if the globalization of money, production, and trade has not delivered a flat earth after all, or a level playing field? In the modern romance with expanding trade, something has gone sour this week in Washington. Something deeper than the nasty tone between Elizabeth Warren and Barack Obama. Here's a sample.
The president says that he wants the American people to judge this deal based on the facts. But to do that, he's got to make the deal public. My view is when the process is rigged, then the outcome's likely to be rigged.
There have been a bunch of critics, and they're my fellow travelers on minimum wage and on job training and on clean energy and on every progressive issue. They're right there with me. And then on this one, they're like whooping on me.
After fighting hard to protect Dodd-Frank for years, Democrats in the next few weeks could give Republicans the very tool they need to dismantle Dodd-Frank.
Think about the logic of that, right? The notion that I had this massive fight with Wall Street to make sure that we don't repeat what happened in 2007, 2008. And then I sign a provision that would unravel it? That doesn't make any sense.
It's those obstructionist Republicans led by Mitch McConnell of Kentucky who are suddenly the president's last solid allies on TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The Republican line is that liberal Democrats like Senator Warren are ready to throw Mr. Obama under his own bus. In the chattering class, Robert Reich is just one of the old apostles of the free trade idea who is saying now it's off the rails, that in 25 years of Clinton, Bush, and Obama globalization, most Americans, a majority, have lost ground. Reich's 50-year comparison is a shocker to me. In 1965, he writes, General Motors was the number one U.S. employer, paying its average worker the equivalent today of $35 an hour. In 2015, Walmart, non-union, is the number one employer, entering wage under $10 an hour. What happened? And how many of the real worries of the world, work and family, equality and climate, are tied up in the politics of trade? The global economist Jeffrey Sachs is our guide through the world that trade made. He's a skeptic on TPP. Robert Lawrence at Harvard and in our studio is an unrepentant free trader. Barry Lynn at the New America Foundation is a prolific writer on globalization. It's making us dependent and vulnerable, he says, in ways we haven't been told. We're also ducking into a very modern clothing factory in New Bedford, Massachusetts, to see just how it's possible to survive in a game that we thought had gone to Asia. Jeff Sachs in New York, welcome back to Open Source.
Great to be with you, Chris. Thank you.
Would you give us your vote up or down and your evaluation of TPP and then your sense of a reckoning coming due on globalization over the last 30 years?
I think what we heard in that exchange of President Obama Senator, when he said, look, why is Elizabeth Warren pounding on me? We're together on minimum wage. We're together on job training. We're together on clean energy. The problem is he hasn't gotten any of those things passed. And now he's saying, despite all of that, we are going to go ahead with this further so-called trade measure, but it's really more a kind of multinational business agreement. Here's the problem. Even the most basic theory of international trade says that while it may be a good thing overall, there will be losers as well as winners. But if it's a good thing overall, the winners could compensate the losers and everybody can come out ahead. But we're in a society now where the losers get trampled, basically. The winners take everything. And there's absolutely no sense of help for those who may come out on the short end of an agreement like this. This is really the problem. The problem is not even with the concepts of trade so much as with the breakdown of politics in Washington to look after the common good. Now, lurking within this agreement, again, called a trade agreement, but really about investment rights, about mechanisms for companies to sue governments, about intellectual property rights, 30 chapters of which very few of the chapters are actually about trade. There are all sorts of corporate goodies all strewn through this that are absolutely unacceptable. They're secret, however, they have not been viewed by the American people. They've been viewed by the lobbyists that are helping to write these draft chapters of the negotiation. And so we have a system that's unfair, inequality that has not only widened by market forces, but then has been exacerbated by politics in our country. And this just adds to the scale. And what President Obama says just doesn't ring true, because we don't have the kind of middle-class economics that he says this is part of and that his allies should jump onto. We have a government run for corporate interests, and this is yet another agreement that would...
We don't have, and you've written this, we don't have retraining programs and family supports or union solidarity or adjustment assistance or a higher minimum wage that would soften the burden. But Jeff, I want to think of this as a 30-year story and a lot of bills coming due. And you've been a player for all of that time. And I know your own enthusiasm going way back about China's recovery and the growth of world trade. What went wrong? And where is this new division between the just disenchanted traders like yourself or people who doubt the result we've come to and the, you know, Obama still plugging the old idea, even though he grants that NAFTA cost us jobs? I mean, where are we in the story?
Where we are, what has happened is that trade has worked more or less as one would expect trade and investment to work, and that is that it has created an expanded world economy. It has helped a lot of poor countries to gain a foothold and to grow, and it has exacerbated income inequalities in our country and elsewhere. What hasn't worked is normal politics. Our country has gone off the rails in our political system. It's a government by the rich, of the rich, and for the rich. And we don't have what I assumed 30 years ago was, as a child of the 60s, was kind of a completely normal idea that there would be adjustment assistance, that there would be worker training, that we'd care for the environment. These things I say I took for granted in the 1970s and early 1980s. President Reagan came in, pushed everything radically to the right, but it's never come back. It's been this way through Bush 1, through Clinton, through Bush 2, through Obama. What we really have is a system of corporate governance. We don't have a democratic polity right now in the sense of representing the interests and needs of the American people.
Civilians.
That's a big surprise. It's not, the surprise isn't really so much about trade. The surprise is about the breakdown of American politics. And enough is enough. We can't keep exacerbating these inequalities unless we get our own politics right. That's why I wrote about this trade agreement. Not that trade is wrong, but that it's got the politics completely backwards.
And the power inside it, as Reich writes, is obvious. Even to people like me who haven't read the TPP, you know, reading about it, that the protections of copyright, of intellectual property held by pharmaceutical companies or by Hollywood, those protections are much more forceful than any enforcement is going to be protecting jobs or the environment.
It's even worse, Chris. There's a section called the Investor-State Dispute Settlement section, ISDS, which is becoming alarming. What it is a section that gives under the treaties, it exists already under many of U.S. bilateral treaties, the right of investors to sue the host country states
right
under the treaty and to supersede the national legal system. What happens is an ad hoc tribunal
right.
gets set up that doesn't have to abide by the national law.
Right.
Now, this has been there for quite a while, but the companies in the last 5 years are absolutely starting to use this to twist every bit of national law out of control and out of focus. Philip Morris is suing Australia on Australia's bid to control tobacco packaging. A Virginia-based mining company operating in trying to operate in Canada couldn't get a permit on regulatory grounds after a review of the project. They sued under NAFTA.
So, but I take it a law overturned. A French company doing business in this country or a Japanese country could say, no, wait a second, we're not governed by the laws of Massachusetts or the United States. We're governed by the terms of the trade agreement.
Absolutely. And what's incredible, just incredible, is Elizabeth Warren has been saying that this would threaten the protections that were put in after the 2008 financial crisis. And President Obama, we heard just now, has completely been rejecting that as foolish. And yet, just today, it's reported, I'm reading it off the wires of CBC News wires, Canada's finance minister, Joe Oliver, told a group of American financiers on Wednesday that an upcoming series of U.S. bank reforms, notably the Volcker Rule, violates the North American Free Trade Agreement. So here we go. It's a complete setup. Now we're going to have ISDS sue to overturn the Volcker Rule.
We've got to talk more about the integrity of our own democracy in this trade agreement, not to mention the security of the environment, not to mention broader measures of human well-being and health and education and even happiness. Don't go away. Coming up, a glimpse of the millwork that survives in our midst and the reasons why it does. We're going to New Bedford, Massachusetts, to the Joseph Aboud suit-making plant. We'll be back with Jeff Sachs and Bob Lawrence and Barry Lynn. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source on the crack and the confidence that global trade works for all of us. Great swaths of manufacturing have disappeared from this country in 30 years, notably in clothing. We wondered this week, what's to learn from survivors like the Joseph Aboud manufacturing plant in New Bedford, Massachusetts, that makes 1,300 suits every day? So our producers, Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, went to look, and company president Tony Sapienza showed them around.
Well, we are one of the last standing American tailored clothing manufacturing facilities. We have 750 employees. We make 1,300 suits every single day of the week.
You're seeing coats that are being built. I mean, they're traveling on the top. They come down all computerized into a chain. I don't think you can call this a sweatshop anymore. Everything is high-tech.
My name is Eva, and I'm quality control here at the company, Joseph Aboud. And I've been with the company for 31 years, going to be 32 next month. And as far as working, doing this in New Bedford, when so many companies have gone overseas, it's sort of awesome that we have the chance. And we've been chosen because of our quality and our hard work to stay local and to do it in New Bedford. Many companies have closed around us. Many, many, many.
We've seen many.
We've seen many. We're like the last in the area, standing, still standing.
I'm Maria Nunes. I've been here for 19 years. I love my job. I am a stitcher. I do the zigzag on the coat.
Our coat is almost like tailor-made. We baste instead of gluing. We press instead of just putting a piece of fuse underneath. You know, we do a lot of steps to our coat compared to them. It's our quality. Yeah, we're very, very proud of our product. We're very proud that it's out there and that it's in New York City now in stores, in a beautiful store.
We'll go to Men's Warehouse and we'll say, I did that pocket, or I did that zigzag. You know, we're proud of it.
Yeah.
There are ways to make clothing in America. And, yeah, I think we're very proud of the fact that this is a union facility. We pay union wages. We have union benefits, vacation pay, pension plan, health insurance, the availability of dental insurance, short-term disability insurance. I mean, there is a standard of living that we have in the United States that this company supports and we believe in for our workers. And there's no question that there are places where product is made overseas where the owners of those companies do not believe in those moral imperatives. And I think they are imperatives.
Barry Lynn is our guest from the New America Foundation in Washington. He's a journalist in book form on the ways of global capitalism. His last book is titled Cornered: The New Monopoly, Capitalism, and the Economics of Destruction. Barry Lynn, count the industries that leave, the industries that stay, and imagine a scorecard and an overall pattern over the last, say, 30, 40 years.
Well, the scorecard over the last 30, 40 years is that we have seen entire industries in the United States essentially move overseas. And, you know, we know that's true of a number of, like, low-level manufacturing activities, you know, bicycles and toys and shoes. But what we're now seeing, and what we've seen over the last 20 years, is manufacturing activities like semiconductors and all the components that go into computers and sort of advanced light bulbs and chemicals, really quite advanced chemical manufacturing. And sometimes, you know, you're talking 50%, 60%. In some cases, we're talking about 100% of really vital components have moved abroad. And in many cases, they moved to one country, and that country is China. So, what, you know, compared to 20, 30 years ago, there has been a revolution in the world. And, you know, it has, as other people have pointed out, it has affected the quality of the jobs in the United States. It has affected the wages that are paid in the United States. It has affected our ability to regulate life here at home. But the thing that has really been revolutionized is whether or not the people of the United States, depend on other people for the things that we need every day. Because that, when you get into dependence on people in someplace far away, it starts to affect your national security.
For example, what are the necessities that we don't make anymore? And what's the risk?
Well, you know, like drugs. You know, it's like if you go into the drugstore, you know, it's like acetaminophen, ibuprofen, you know, tetracycline. Most of that, those products, in some cases all of those products, come from China. 100% of the iPhones in the United States come from China. Most of the, you know, basically every single smartphone in the world has components that come out of China. Every single thing that we make in the United States, the cars in Detroit, the airplanes that come off the assembly line in Washington State, these all have massive number of components that come only from China.
That's the glory of a free world market, no?
Well, it could be. You know, it's like, you know, there's different ways to organize, a global system. You know, we actually had, for a while, we had a really quite marvelous global system. That was sort of the first era of globalization from the end of the Second World War until the mid-1990s. And we had all of these activities spread all over the world, and no one was really dependent on anyone else. Yet there was quite a bit of free trade, liberal trade, among the democracies of the world up to that point. What we now have is a different kind of globalization in which all of many things are made in one place. And that creates political dynamics that we don't really understand, because this is something entirely new.
I want to get Bob Lawrence in on the conversation from the Harvard Kennedy School at Harvard. What's changed, Bob, in the new regime? And do you see a threat here?
Well, I think, firstly, that the dominant source of the decline in our manufacturing employment is not trade. Actually, if you look at what's happened to the share of employment in the U.S. in the manufacturing industries, and you look in Germany or in the Netherlands, you'll find the declines are exactly the same in percentage terms. So it's something that's happening throughout the industrial world. And basically, it's being driven by a combination of two things. Firstly, faster productivity growth in the production of goods. Automation, technological change, and innovation have allowed us to produce the same quantity of goods with far fewer workers. The second aspect of this is that our demand for goods is not very responsive to the fact that they're getting cheaper. In a sense, if you ask yourself, would you rather have the money you pay for your cell phone, which you know has been falling in price, or your TV, or the money you pay to the phone company or the cable company in order to use those products? So what's been happening is a massive increase in the demand for services. It's more or less a repeat of what happened in farming. Basically, we didn't deprive ourselves of food, but faster productivity growth combined with the way we responded to that, that's the really big picture. And then there's trade. And I would agree what's happened is we've become specialized. And in a sense, global production has changed in its nature. We used to think of trade as being a product is made in one country and sold in another. And today, products are made in the world, in large global supply chains. And that's what Barry described. And I think he's absolutely right. Now, this has caused dislocation. And trade allows us to get higher living standards. But again, what we haven't been good at is adjustment policies that help workers who are dislocated.
Whose fault is that, and why in the world haven't we rebuilt our own society around this new regime?
Well, I think we have failed to respond. As Jeffrey put it, our democracy is broken. We're not investing in our people. Actually, we're not investing, period. We're not investing in our infrastructure. We're not investing in skills development and in the adjustment to the changes that are taking place, both because of technology and because of trade. So and by the way, the question, though, is even if we don't do those things, are we going to be better off simply putting our heads in the sand? Are we just going to say no to this proposed trade agreement and then allow China to actually write the rules of the global trading system? So while I agree that we have deficiencies that Jeff pointed out in terms of the way we help workers or don't help workers, the real question facing us today is, are we better off being in the game and negotiating for the kind of agreements we like, or are we going to let others do it instead of us?
Jeff Sachs, that's a question for you. Are we getting back in the game with TPP or still outside?
Well, I think the point is that when it says, are we better off, it depends who you are. Some parts of the country and our society will be worse off and others will be better off. And it's not right to say we, precisely because we don't share. And that's why there's real politics in this. Of course, it's a shame. I think Bob and I would agree on both what should be done and agree certainly on the basic context that with trade, there is a responsibility to have a society that builds policies around that. I think I differ with both Barry and Bob in certain ways. First, on the interdependence issue, I think that's an existential reality for everybody. We're interdependent on international trade and on others, and frankly, I see that as good for humanity, not bad for humanity. The idea that the United States alone should be somehow protected against, quote, dependency, well, every other country in the world depends on us and our technologies, and we depend on others, and maybe we could actually get along, which would be a good thing. On the effects of trade, this is, of course, an inside debate among economists. There is, I think, now a general agreement that both trade and technology have played their role in widening inequality. There is also, with Bob, an agreement that we haven't done much in response to either of those two forces. But I would also say that the evidence in recent years leans more and more to really underscoring that trade has played its part and a meaningful part in the widening inequalities in the labor market. I'm holding in front of me a working paper from March of this year, an NBR working paper, which says, "We find significant effects of globalization with offshoring to low-wage countries and imports both associated with wage declines for U.S. workers. We present evidence that globalization has led to the reallocation of workers away from high-wage manufacturing jobs into other sectors and other occupations with large declines in wages among workers who switch, explaining the large differences between industry and occupational analyses." It's one of many recent studies that says, in by a variety of methods of analysis, if you happen to be in the way of China's imports or in an industry where there's been a lot of outsourcing, you've been hit. And if you're in an occupation that's been especially vulnerable to that, you've been hit pretty hard.
But can I put it in street language for you, Bob? There's been a huge upward redistribution of wealth, but also demonstrably of power.
Well,
and it's all written in this agreement.
Well, let me get back to the question of what is trade doing in all of this. Actually, Jeffrey's colleagues at Columbia have done a very interesting study. What they ask is, who benefits from international trade? Is
Please.
It the rich or is it the poor? And this is from the standpoint, of course, of the benefits from trade, which come in the area of consumption. And what they find is that the typical worker in the 10th percentile, a poor worker, would have their living standards lowered by 29% if we didn't have trade. They find that workers at the very top would have their living standards lowered by 3%. The richest would have their standards lowered by 3%. That's because so much of trade involves goods.
Who's discovering all this at Columbia?
I agree with Jeffrey that who we are is very important. But we also need to do a calculation from the standpoint of the U.S. I've calculated, actually, taking account of the costs of the people who dislocated and the incomes that they've lost due to changing out of manufacturing, and then compared it to the gains that accrue to the society as a whole. And what I find is that the benefit-cost ratio is hugely positive, and it grows over time. So we have to adjust to this world, and once we have, broad benefits are going to be accruing.
Jeff, who thinks, besides Bob Lawrence, that the median worker, the median family in this country is better off than it was before before the globalization era? Dare I say, before the Chinese took over making everything?
Well, again, I just want to emphasize there are, I think, also, like Bob, net gains from trade. If you tally up the winners on one side and the losers, what the problem is how mean our country has gotten in its political system. It's not even the American people. This is just a system that has now become incapable of even putting safety switches on Amtrak tracks, keeping the highway trust fund alive, giving worker training. We're mean in this country. Washington is a despicable set of politicians right now. And it's across both parties, by the way, although the Republicans are obviously the cheerleaders of the worst of it. And that's why we can't talk about we. It goes way back to the first ideas about trade. And it certainly goes back to the trade that Bob Lawrence and I were trained in that was in the age of Paul Samuelson, who presented modern trade theory, always emphasizing every moment that it was put that the gains from trade will have distributional effects that need to be compensated. And if we live in an unfair society, and just talking about the net gains, and if we have been now 30 years of widening income inequality in this country and abuse of corporate power that is rampant, because I want to remind everybody that these two agreements are called trade agreements, but most of what's in them are not about trade. They're about regulation. They're about the environment. They're about copyright. They're about intellectual property. And think of how abused we are by the pharmaceutical industry in this country, selling drugs for $1,000 a pill that cost $1 to produce and that were developed on the basis of NIH funding. We've turned the keys over to the corporate sector, and this just adds to it. And it's got the politics wrong. I'm not against trade, never have been. But I am against this kind of abusive politics. And we can't talk about gains if we don't talk about losses and do something about it.
Well, we're going to come back to this after a break. Bob Lawrence would grant that our political system is broken. Next question, do we proceed as if it weren't? I'm not sure. Coming up, and come to think of it, how did we get sold on the bounty of outsourcing? We'll tell you why. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Ledden. This is Open Source. With President Obama's Trans-Pacific trade deal hung up in Congress between Republicans in support and Democrats in opposition, we may be looking at the comeuppance of a shaky platform of economic policy that goes back 30 years. Here is a taste of the New York Times columnist Tom Friedman in high promotional mode for a sequel to his bestseller, The World is Flat.
America is the tentpole that holds up the global system. And if that tentpole buckles or frays, your kids won't just grow up in a different America or Brazil or Turkey or China. They'll grow up in a different world. That in the last 10 years, the world's actually gone from connected to hyperconnected. When I sat down to write The World is Flat, Facebook didn't exist, Twitter was still a sound, the cloud was still in the sky, 4G was a parking place, LinkedIn was a prison, applications were what you sent to college, and Skype was a typo. Made in the world is the world we live in. Maybe imagined here, marketed there, designed there, sold everywhere. It's no longer made in America, it's made in the world. Here's the good news. America is hardwired to succeed in that world.
Barry Lynn, Bob Lawrence, Jeff Sachs. It sounds like a takeoff, but that is Tom Friedman's voice and Tom Friedman's idea that globalization was the magic elixir. Barry Lynn, I mean, have at it in your terms.
Well, you know, I think that the Tom Friedman is about 20 years behind the times. And
that tape may be 10 years old, so.
20 years ago, 1995, I, too, was a strong supporter of the interdependence among nations, based with the idea being that this would lead to peace and prosperity around the world. 20 years ago, Bill Clinton came to the American people and said, if we seek this kind of interdependence with China, if we open up the doors of the WTO with China, what we're going to see is a liberalization in China. And we're going to see the Chinese become productive and peaceful members of the world community. Yesterday, we saw that the Pentagon announced that they were planning to send a fleet into the South China Sea to ensure freedom of navigation. Last year, we had the we sent planes. The Chinese actually announced a sort of air defense zone in which they essentially annexed a large part of the East China Sea. And we had planes that were sort of running into conflict with the Chinese. Clearly, after 20 years, we have a problem here. What we were promised, which was peace and prosperity, which was a liberal China, that's not coming to pass. We actually have now a China that's far more belligerent than it was 20 years ago, far more apt to challenge the power of not just Japan, not just the Philippines, but the United States.
But it's a China that's...
Bob Lawrence, please.
But
go ahead.
I think it's a China that's far more dependent on the rest of the world. And the Chinese understand this. And in fact, if you go to Beijing, I was there last week, what you'll see is they're rethinking their trade strategy. And the reason they are is that they are part of these global supply chains that you describe, but they're not doing much. They're doing the simple assembly parts. The parts are coming from all over Asia and elsewhere. And in fact, the big value added in that iPhone that you spoke about earlier are the profits that are made by an American company. So there's a mutual dependence there.
I agree. I mean, it's like that's all true. But the thing is the issue, what we have to ask ourselves is what happens if push comes to shove over the Senkakus in the South China Sea, perhaps? And what happens, and who is more dependent on whom at that moment?
Well, actually, what you've seen is that there's
there are all these things that we import into the United States on a just-in-time basis, things like the drugs on our shelves, the electronics in our pockets, things that we need every day. We're importing them on a just-in-time basis.
You think the Chinese want to get into a trade war? The Chinese are the last. China's whole economy is dependent on its exports, and the last thing they want is a trade war. And they are restructuring their economy in order to make that happen.
I want Jeff Sachs on this subject because you've been in and out of China for as long as I've known you, Jeff, 30 years or more. And I'm wondering, isn't part of the whole story that China is a much tougher customer, competitor? I don't think they want trade wars or any other kind, but they are much less malleable in terms of rules, work rules, environmental rules, and nudgeable than we thought. And in 25 years, they have grown unbelievably. But they've also revealed themselves as very stubbornly a Maoist capitalist state, hyper-capitalist, and still a very tough dictatorship.
Well, one thing's for sure. The rise of China is one of the most consequential, deep, and real phenomena of modern times.
For sure.
The presumption that somehow the North Atlantic will run the world is an illusion from the long sweep of history, but one that many people have bought into over two centuries, and it's ending. And China is now a very powerful country. It is a much richer country. It has been enormously well managed economically over the last 35 years. One could say the greatest economic development phase in known history. The Chinese leadership is extremely competent, very serious, very much committed to China's rise in economic terms and in geopolitical terms. It's not surprising. The success is surprising in that it is stunning. And by the way, globalization has been the most important single phenomenon for China without question. They're part of the global system. They're doing a lot of things very well that we once knew how to do and have completely lost. I, too, was in China over the course of a week, about 3 weeks ago, and had the chance to meet with President Xi and with Prime Minister Li Ka-shing, and attended two meetings where China was rolling out its new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB. China is putting hundreds of billions of dollars now into infrastructure investment all over Asia to improve logistics, to improve transport, both passenger and rail and aviation. China is working across Asia, and all the leaders were there because
everybody is
so keen on these investments. Of course, China is a major rising power.
Now, Jeffrey, I want to ask you a question.
Now, we should work with
it. Jeff, let me ask you a question then. Let's think about international trade. Now, we have an initiative in the Pacific that is working, that is forcing the Chinese actually to change their strategy and come up with a response. Now, if we go along with what you're prescribing, we get out of the game.
But Bob, I think the idea, and you know, in Congress this afternoon, You had the Pentagon rolling out and State Department rolling out that we must sign these agreements for geopolitical reasons, that if we don't sign them, China will. I find this juvenile, frankly. I find it the worst argument.
Wait a minute. It's not that China...
No, let Jeff make his point. Go ahead.
That's what the Defense Department is saying. It's saying, and that's what the congressman that I talked to this afternoon said to me, they're saying, which is we've got to write this with all the abuses, by the way, because if we don't, then China's going to write the rules. But this is absurd because, of course, we need a framework with China included as well. And the idea that somehow the U.S. is going to corner the game by quickly making TPP and will be the ones writing the history of Asia is absurd.
Jeffrey, that's not the strategy.
Well, that is what they're saying.
No, but you're mischaracterizing the strategy. The strategy is we first sign a free trade agreement in the Pacific, then we sign another trade agreement with Europe, and that is going to put pressure on the Chinese and others to be much more forthcoming in the WTO, in the world trading system. So
that's
this is
probably
a coherent strategy.
That's a really great point. And that's the key thing that we have to keep our eyes on when we're talking about the TPP. The White House is presenting, and with the DOD at their side, they're presenting the TPP as a geostrategic agreement. This is something that is necessary for our national security. I'm not saying this. The White House is saying this. But that's also an admission. When the White House says that we need the TPP for our national security, it's an admission that there's something fundamentally flawed with the system, the WTO system, that we agreed to 20 years ago. Now, the problem that we have to address with the TPP is that it's not sufficient to deal with the fundamental flaws in the WTO system as they are revealing themselves.
I agree, and that's why we have to use these regional trade agreements in a complementary fashion in order to change the global trading system. And if we simply withdraw from this process, what will happen is, and here again I disagree with Jeff, it'll be the Chinese with their Asian initiatives that will set the parameters.
Oh, come on. This is going to be set in negotiations, but it can be set in negotiations with some decency and with some openness and with some civility, not set by corporate lobbies who have absolutely no public interest in mind.
Do you believe that?
It's really ridiculous for the administration to be trotting out the Defense Department on this rather than showing the American people the treaties and asking them, is this what you want to happen to intellectual property rights? Is this what you want to happen on dispute settlement? This is ridiculous.
This is a matter of national security that we have ISDS
in this agreement. It's absurd.
Well, the first thing is this.
You know, it's a
Jeffrey,
game to try to put pressure on senators to sign something that the corporate lobbies are pushing for. It has nothing to do with our national security.
Jeff, why you're seeing President Xi last week. Why isn't President Obama sitting on a long weekend over there or Camp David, any place they want, and working on these things directly?
What's amazing to me, Chris, and you put your finger on it, I am all over the world in these meetings in recent years. The U.S. is not present. You had heads of state across Asia and Europe at the meeting where they unveiled the AIIB. As people may have read, when China announced this new bank, the United States told everybody, don't join, but all of our allies joined because they want to be part of this commercially smart system. The United States is nowhere to be seen on this, and the United States is basically nowhere to be seen on anything other than in war zones right now.
Well, we have a trade agreement.
From the point of view of normal engagement with other countries. And
we have a trade agreement that,
problem.
Jeffrey, we have a trade agreement that you've mischaracterized. There are 29 dimensions to this thing. There are 29 chapters. Firstly, when it comes to the ISDS, if you actually look at the wording of our agreement when it comes to Australia, actually, we've made very clear that you can't sue for regulatory changes.
I don't want to get it too deep into the weeds of the agreement itself. I'm much more interested in the theme. It's part of your line too, Barry, that the United States, as a government, as a nation, dropped out of this bargain. Basically, when the Cold War was over, it's now the terrain of the banks and the mega corporations.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what we saw with the WTO system. If you really want to simplify down the agreement that we signed back in 1994, that was put into place in 1995, that was a decision by the U.S. government, or by people who had control over the U.S. government, to get the government out of the job of regulating trade, and to essentially turn over the job of regulating trade to the people who run our corporations, to the people who run our banks.
To the point that the chiefs of state of our country in China can't be inclusive in a consideration of huge importance, that we have to rattle the Pentagon, put a new base in Australia to get their attention. It does seem absurd.
That's actually a really important issue. Going back to the origins of this country, to the beginning of the United States, we use for 200 years trade power parallel with our military power to keep ourselves free and to ensure as much as possible peace around the world. We did so in very sophisticated ways. We were the ones that created, by decree, this interdependent world that Jeff Sachs was praising before, and rightly so. What happened in 1995, however, is if you want to have a safe kind of interdependence, the state has to be at the table to make sure that the people who run corporations and banks are not making unwise decisions for selfish reasons.
Barry, I take your point, but I want to hear
decisions for selfish reasons that have placed us in an extremely perilous political position vis-a-vis China.
Jeffrey Sachs, give us a vision of the next step here. It's getting ugly in Washington. I mean, when Elizabeth Warren and the president, I mean, these are kinfolk, are going at it this way. Something's afoot. Get it back on track, can you?
Well, I think that this trade promotion authority is likely to pass, and I find that mainly the power of the corporations, which is not only not abated by all of the scandals and the shocks, but continues to dominate. I'm frankly more scared of what these companies can do in the regulations than I am about our dependence on trade with China. For that, I would rather that we have continuing to develop good, strong relations of the number one and the number two economies of the world so that it is a healthy and peaceful relationship, which I believe to be possible, but also which is highly vulnerable, history tells us, to becoming a source of conflict. And that's why I'm very much against viewing trade agreements as we must do this so that they don't do this. And we must sign TPP so that China doesn't write the rules. Why don't we write the rules together rather than trying to play these games? I don't like the strategy, and I don't like to listen to generals tell us how important trade agreements are. It's a bad approach.
Bob Lawrence, last short word on another way to do this thing.
No, we will be able to sit at the table with China once we've concluded this agreement, because it's attracted their attention to the point where already they're starting to change the way they behave. So I think this is part of a strategy to get them to sit down and to talk to us.
Will they notice, Barry Lynn?
They'll notice only if we actually get control back over our banks and our corporations. Right now, they're free actors around the world. They're serving their own interests. Increasingly, those same banks and corporations that have American flags on them are operating in alliance with China.
Barry Lynn, thank you. Jeff Sachs, thank you. And Robert Lawrence in our studio. Thanks also to Rick Locke and Joseph Aboud and the staff of his New Bedford Suit Factory. You can see and hear more on the Suit Factory visit at radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by Pat Tomino, Max Larkin, and Connor Gillies. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our trade rep. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.